From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the producers of that great film, What the Bleep, joins us. Here's what's happening. The Las Vegas gunman behind that deadliest mass shooting, the biggest in modern U.S. history, spent decades, apparently, stockpiling guns and living a very secret life that investigators still may never be able to piece together to fully understand what happened. Clark County, Nevada Sheriff Joseph Lombardo said that it was only logical to make the assumption that Stephen Paddock had some kind of help at some point in pulling off Sunday's massacre in Las Vegas. As evidence, Lombardo pointed to a gunman Paddock's huge arsenal, explosive materials found in his car, and his meticulous planning. He also may have been planning shootings in Chicago and Boston as well. A 24-year-old Washington woman who dreamed of becoming a serial killer by murdering a man she met online and eating out his heart has been sentenced to 18 years in prison. Amy Carolyn Brown pleaded guilty last month to attempting to kill a 29-year-old man that she met on Craigslist in January after she stabbed him in the lung with a pocket knife. The victim told police that he met Brown on Craigslist and that the two went on a date that ended up at a Seattle area motel. Well, the man told police that Brown asked him several times if he was a serial killer, and of course he said no. Then the 24-year-old jumped on him, attacked him, and stabbed him with a knife. Nuclear-armed North Korea said that its missile launches were training for a strike on U.S. bases in Japan as global condemnation of the regime begins to swell. Charles R. Smith, our expert on Korea, with us. Charles, I know what you've been saying over the months, that you do not believe there's going to be any armed military conflict here, but I thought I'd ask you again. Is there?
Nothing on the horizon as of yet, although we have some events in the mid-month with the celebration of the October Revolution and the Chinese Congress meeting, so it's quite possible that the North Koreans may decide to set off a firecracker or send up a bottle rocket.
If they do that again, I just have a feeling that this administration is going to retaliate.
Well, if it's over Japan like they did last time, we may just sit back and watch it. If it's aimed at a U.S. territory, such as Guam, there might be a different reaction. So we'll have to see. Again, we've seen some motions in different areas. For example, in the cyberspace area, we had a denial of service attack where we, the United States, applied a DOS attack against the North Korean Reconnaissance Bureau. However, it seems that the North Koreans have moved and, by using their connection with the Russians, have established a brand new internet connection through TransTelcom, which is a state-owned firm in Russia.
Charlie, does Japan have the capability to fight back on its own against North Korea?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't have the offensive capability. That's something that they are reviewing. There has been discussion by the Abe government to purchase cruise missiles for longer-range strike, and it's in part and parcel because of their reluctance to arm themselves with offensive weapons. So, no, the Japanese probably do not have the offensive punch to do so, but could if they wished.
Okay, Charles, we'll check in with you next week. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that dozens of people have been sickened with infections linked to puppies sold at Petland pet stores. The outbreak has affected 55 people in 12 states. 13 people have been hospitalized. This is an increase from the 39 cases reported in 7 states last month. Infections can be spread by contact with dog feces. October's full harvest moon will shine all night tonight while passing by or fully covering Neptune in some parts of the world in the pre-dawn hours. You'll also get another celestial show with Mars and Venus close together in the eastern sky. Listen to this story. A Casper, Wyoming man claiming to be from the future has been arrested for having too much to drink in the present time. Casper police officers say around 10:30 p.m., they were dispatched to a residence on East 2nd Street for a man who was stating that he was from the future and he was there to help people. They found Bryant Johnson, who claimed he was from the year 2048, and was trying to warn the people of Casper, Wyoming, that aliens were coming next year and they should leave as soon as possible. He added that he wanted to speak to the president of the town. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, what do you have for us this week?
You know, I listened to these news reports you put on, George, and I don't feel quite as strange studying UFOs as might otherwise be the case. There's a lot going on. And I was just out looking at the moon tonight. Beautiful full moon.
Gorgeous.
It's really something. Well, we just updated our website and posted about 141 new reports collected over the last 7 days. One takes us back to the late 1960s, a very, very intriguing report submitted by a gentleman who was writing on behalf of a friend of his, a young woman aged 92, who had a friend aged 94 who worked on the Lunar Surveyor project back in the late 1960s. He just tragically passed away very shortly ago, but towards the end of his life, she reports, he confided in her some very intriguing reports about the things that the lunar surveyors allegedly detected on the surface of the moon. They found collapsed domes, machine debris, kilometers of various surface tracks, and numerous buildings. If anybody's interested in what was going on in NASA back in the 1960s, I commend that report to their attention. More recently, 8 days ago, Pottstown and Trenton, Pennsylvania, gentleman writes that he and his daughter were flying from Pottstown, which is up northwest of Philadelphia, to Trenton. And on their way, it's only about a 40 or 50 mile trip, they looked out ahead of their aircraft and they saw a red cylindrical shaped object oriented vertically in the sky. The pilot, the father, got on the horn and called the air traffic control system, asked them if they had anything out ahead of him at his altitude. Technically, there should have been nothing there, George, but it was, and they did not see it on radar. They reported negatively. They could not see it at all. Very interesting report. More recently, last night, in the Portland area, two very well-prepared, very convincing reports of a white light that was seen streaking at a very low altitude, apparently, and apparently just ahead of a heavy military helicopter streaking very close to Portland International Airport. And the final report comes from Flint, Michigan this morning, 7:30 a.m., husband and wife, team drivers, truck drivers, saw approximately 10 diamond-shaped objects with a very intensely bright light on top of it. They tracked them for several minutes before the objects just suddenly accelerated and zipped away. So a lot going on, and I commend these reports and many others to the attention of the Coast listeners.
You got it. Peter, thank you. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Up next, William Keller joins me. Democracy Betrayed, the Rise of the Surveillance Security State, next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast with our special guest, William Keller. His work is called Democracy Betrayed. William has worked as a security analyst for the United States Congress for 10 years, as the executive director of the Center for International Studies at MIT, as well as professor of international affairs and director of the Ridgeway Center for the International Security Studies at the University of Pittsburgh. Most recently, he served as a professor and director of the Center for International Trade and Security at the University of Georgia. He has held the highest security clearances and has written extensively about the FBI, defense technology, multinational corporations, and the arms trade. William Keller with us on Coast to Coast. Pretty prolific author as well, William. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, George, for having me.
I'm looking forward to this. You know, we have, God, we're going through some weird, strange times these days, aren't we?
It does appear to be that way, yes.
Are we being manipulated, do you think? You know, I'm going to get into the things that have changed since 9/11 in a minute with you, but in your opinion, is all this necessary, what's happening?
Well, if you mean all of the preparations we've made for terrorist attacks and all the investment we've made into it, is that the question?
Yeah, sort of. There's going to be a follow-up in just a sec.
Okay, well, I would say that since 9/11, we really have constructed what I call a security industrial complex. And that's analogous to what Eisenhower talked about when in his last speech to the nation when he talked about the military industrial complex. But there's a difference there, and that's because the military is typically outwardly directed against our enemies. But this complex is comprised of 17 intelligence agencies, and it's not just the ones you know about, like the CIA, the FBI, and the National Security Agency. It's also the really less well-known ones, like the Bureau of Intelligence at State and the Office of Intelligence and Counterintelligence at the Energy Department and the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. So, you know, if I try to separate all these agencies, it's tough to do. Broadly speaking, there is a National Intelligence Program that would be the FBI and the DIA, and there's, separate from that, a military intelligence program that would be like the Defense Intelligence mm-hmm. Agency and the National Security Agency. But the division's not all that clear because you have the CIA, and it seems to be in the middle. It has national missions, and it has military missions like the drone assassinations it carries out. It's got drone bases in a number of countries. So to me, the security industrial complex it's really more than this. It includes not just the department. It includes also the Department of Homeland Security.
Sure.
And many elements of state and local police. And get this, George, the high-tech companies in the commercial sector like Google, AT&T, Verizon, and Apple, they have been very complicit in conducting surveillance on American citizens. So I would say all of these entities are conducting massive surveillance most often, or very often, over the Internet, and the government apportion of it alone comes to about $120 billion a year.
Wow.
And that's a big figure. You know, if you thought about what you could do with $120 billion, you could probably knock down every elementary and high school in the country and build brand new ones.
Build new ones, insulate the power grid against an EMP attack or a solar flare. We could do all kinds of things with that kind of money.
But the thing is, we don't know what these guys are doing. And there are hundreds of thousands of government employees and contractors, and it's just the sheer size and magnitude of the surveillance security state. It's really unprecedented. And the only benchmark we have, I guess, I don't want to talk for too long, but if you want me to go on, I will.
No, go ahead. You're with me for 2 hours, so we've got all the time in the world.
It's the one precedent we have is the Church Committee, which was a congressional committee that was put together in 1975, and the idea was to investigate all the programs that the FBI and the intelligence agencies had put together that threatened the American society at that time. And this was done, this is very strange, in a town called Media, Pennsylvania. Some Vietnam anti-war group broke into the FBI office and stole their secret files.
Huh.
And then they started to release these things, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal.
It was the WikiLeaks before we had WikiLeaks, wasn't it?
Yeah, this was just an actual breaking where they took the real paper files. Remember, this is before we have real computers.
That's right.
And what happened was the Congress got so up in arms, Frank Church, a senator there, and Walter Mondale, who later became vice president, and a bunch of others, really brought the Intelligence Committee under control, the whole community under control. They cut their budgets, they published their secret documents, and they really made them accountable to the American people for the first time. Well, here's the question. Then along comes 9/11 years later. We thought we had it sort of beat, you know, that we get an intelligence community that's right-sized for the missions it has to undertake. But since 9/11, we've actually quadrupled the size of it, even more than that. And I would say that the Congress does not have the power now to rein in the intelligence agencies and the security industrial complex if it should decide to do so.
You know, with this tragedy that occurred Sunday night in Las Vegas, how come we don't have the capability of somewhere along the line picking up something from this nut job who obviously was planning this for a long, long time, and now we hear today, William, that he wanted to do the same thing in Chicago or Boston as well. Why doesn't the intelligence services pick up anything like that?
It might have been as well, or it might have been instead, you know. And usually when a terrorist is caught, like the ones that shot up Paris and other places in recent years, the police usually do know about them. It's just you can't keep surveilling them. Now, there's also this phenomenon of the single security point failure. And what that means is that only one person knows that something's going to happen. And if they don't tell anybody, and they don't make any records, there really is no defense. Now, this guy was so extensive, what he did in Las Vegas, you know, getting all those special stops for his gun and having so many weapons, you would have thought
somebody would have flagged him.
Someone would have flagged it and said, this guy, what on earth does he need, you know, would he have 12 bump stocks?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what did he need that for? Because, you know, so these things do fly under the radar, and that's a very tough thing to figure out.
Well, when you say they fly under the radar, do they fly under the radar because of a mistake or something has gone awry, or does the technology simply miss it?
Well, there's the rub. I mean, you have to think about how many people you're actually talking about. You see, because if these people don't exhibit some kind of behavior, or don't have a criminal record, don't do something that really makes them outstanding, and so they get brought to the attention of the police, then it's very hard to pick them up. So what the reaction has been since 9/11 is to build ever more powerful surveillance platforms and to upgrade surveillance technology and to begin to look at many, many things in people's lives.
I mean, let's say, for instance, this guy went online over the past couple of years to look at all kinds of things, ammo, rifles, assault weapons, places to go. Would that have, because where surveillance is everywhere, would that have caught him? Would that have flagged him?
Yeah, I see what you're punching a hole in now. It's very interesting, is the real strategy of the United States. And our strategy is to cover everything, to look at everything,
yeah,
and to have more information and more information. And it's not a very effective strategy. What you want to do is focus on the things that really, the people who really matter or the things that really matter. And I guess now is a good time to point out that in the United States, there's very little terrorism, almost none. And yet, do you know that when people are surveyed in public opinion polls, over 50% of the people say that they believe that they, or a member of their family, will be a victim of a terrorist incident?
Yeah. Now, when you say, though, very little, almost none, of course, we had 9/11, we had the Boston Marathon, we've had some smart. Are you saying we have very little on an ongoing basis? Or what did you mean by that?
You have to go back to 1970 when we had about 450 terrorist events. And then you come forward and it's been dropping steadily. So that by 1990, we had maybe like 25 terrorist events. And then by the time you get to 9/11, we got like 15. And then after that, there's like 10 or 3, and some years, zero terrorist events.
Interesting take. Stay with us. Well, I'm going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. William Keller with us. His work is called Democracy Betrayed. The subtitle, of course, means a lot, too. The Rise of the Security of the Surveillance Security State. Well, our annual Ghost to Go show will be Tuesday, October 31st, Halloween night, and we'd like you to email us some of your best and favorite ghost stories, because you could get on the air that night. Email your name and phone number and that great ghost story to ghoststories@coasttocoastam.com. Full information as well at our carousel at coasttocoastam.com. But ghoststories@coasttocoastam.com include your phone number, your name, and your ghost story. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, William Keller with us. Democracy Betrayed is his latest work. He's got several others out there, Arm in Arm, The Liberals, and J. Edgar Hoover. I'd love to talk with you one day about Hoover, William. That would be a great show.
It could. We could do that.
Back to 9/11 for a second. Was somebody asleep at the wheel when all this was happening? Or did they know something was happening and they just said, let's just let it happen because look at the things we can do afterwards? What do you think?
Well, I would just be guessing in this instance, because I don't have any real direct data or information on the subject. But I can't believe that if they had known about it, they wouldn't have stopped it. It's just too horrendous an event in the history of mankind. So I suspect that we were just caught. I mean, think about this. For many, many years, have you ever traveled to Israel, George?
I have not, no. Well, I'd like to do that one day. I may do
that.
Yeah,
you should. When you go to Israel, you'll find that all the security is in place. And 15 years ago or 20 years ago, before 9/11, all of Israel's cockpits were hardened.
Would this Vegas situation have occurred in Israel?
It's hard to. I doubt it. I mean, it's they would have been. They're a lot more security conscious. They're also a much smaller country. They have less forums, less things. We're very vulnerable, and that's because we're an open society. We're a democracy. We're a free people, and we're supposed to be able to say what we want to say and basically do what we want to do as long as, it's not against the law. So, it's very difficult to defend the United States from someone doing what the fellow did in Las Vegas over the weekend.
Okay, so...
You hardened every single high school football game around the country, just tens of thousands of them. Can you harden every school And if you go through this process of hardening every ballpark and putting security everywhere, I'll guarantee you that when you get the job done, you probably never will get it. But if you did get it done, you wouldn't have a free and open liberal democracy.
True.
Anymore.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I support the Second Amendment and, concealed carry for people. Because, if this nut job had been on the ground, it's conceivable that some off-duty police officers who were at that concert, one died for sure, they might have been able to stop the guy.
It is possible. People do get stopped from doing things, but this particular tactic, it would be very, very hard to deal with unless you could actually get a sight on the guy.
And that's right.
The only person that's going to do that is a highly trained sniper. Since there was no warning, you can't get a person to the place in time.
No, I guess you'd see the gunshot flashes if you looked up when he was doing this. But you're right. It would have been very difficult to stop him or slow him down. But since 9/11, look what has happened. And look at the places we've gone. We're still in Afghanistan. We're still in Iraq. Why are we there? It just seems to me, William, that we want to be there.
Well, first of all, it's a policy decision to be there. And I think that the other thing that happens is once one president commits us, it's very, very hard to pull back.
Right. For a couple of reasons. One includes the poor people who are there that we went in to support. If we leave, there's going to be genocide in those countries.
Yeah, well, think of it this way. There was no ISIS before the United States broke the security system that Saddam had in place.
That's right.
Saddam was a louse and a murderer and everything else, but the fact of the matter is that he kept people under control in that country, and if we had never gone in, we wouldn't have had that problem. Now, interestingly enough, we went in because the intelligence community allowed the Bush administration to believe that there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and of course now we know there weren't, and in fact we knew at the time, but once you're in there, then we're in there sort of perpetually.
Yeah.
But there's another philosophical point, and that is that after 9/11, we just decided that this could never, ever happen again. And so we began to sort of build up our resources to counter terrorism, and we made foreign policy an instrument of counter terrorism. Now, that sounds a little strange, but that's what's animating it today. We're afraid to walk out because we think ISIS would get the upper hand,
mm-hmm.
and then we'd have a terrorist menace come to our country. I don't think that's true. I think that there is a whole lot. There are a whole lot of politicians and unelected representatives of the intelligence community that really play on the fear of terrorism. Now, let me go on a little bit, if I may. If you exclude the lone wolf psychopaths, right, like the terror in Las Vegas.
Like him, that's right.
Yeah. Then the United States has very little terror. And the other thing to know is the word terrorism remains pretty much undefined. It's elusive. I mean, we could say, okay, there's you know, like 400 definitions of it, but here's one. I would say it's defined as a non-state violence, you know, not a country, but with a political motivation. But if you take that particular view, then you have to say that, you know, George Washington and Menachem Begum of Israel and Ben Bella of Algeria were all terrorists because they blew things up and they used terrorist tactics. They used asymmetrical warfare. And all three of these men became heads of state.
Mm-hmm.
And so as it turns out, the victors in conflicts tend to write the history. And they decide who is and who is not the terrorist. In the U.S., terrorism has been blown all out of perspective. And this is not to minimize 9/11. 9/11 was the worst terrorist event in the history of the world to date.
Yes.
At least that we're aware of.
Yes.
But following 9/11, while the U.S. constructed a surveillance security state, we spent hundreds of billions of dollars, and there was almost no terrorism. In fact, the number of terrorist attacks in the United States just steadily declined, as I mentioned earlier. And in the past decade, the yearly totals have been as low as zero and as high as 10 terrorist attacks. Now, if you compare that to gun violence, this year alone, there have been about 10,000 deaths. We would not call a terrorist attack. Now, I might call them a terrorist attack, but the FBI is not calling them terrorist attacks. It's when a three-year-old plays, somebody's irresponsible and leaves a gun around, and the three-year-old plays with it and gets shot. Or somebody sticks up a 7-Eleven and the clerk gets killed. Or anything. But there are there are 10,000 gun deaths to date this year, and there probably have been only about three or four terrorist events. In fact, I can't think of one.
No, you're absolutely right with that.
So why do we have to spend all this money, except that it's politicians who are dishonest, and they're telling the people, we have to have all this money for these things, we have to have all these agencies, we have to build up our counterterrorism, we have to engage ourselves in these foreign wars, and I don't think they're saying it because it's true. I think they're saying it because they want to get elected.
Well, if we cut back to pre-9/11,
mm-hmm.
that $120 billion you quoted would be what?
Well, 30, maybe.
30. And would we still be secure?
Yeah, I'd be just about as secure as we are today. I believe that is the,
okay.
the case. It's every time we do something to counter terrorism, we have to be careful that there's not an equal and opposite reaction. So, like, for instance, you could say we went into Iraq to counter terrorism, or once we were there, we were countering terrorism. We had to fight Al-Qaeda of Iraq, for example, which was a terrible organization that teamed up with forces, against the American forces. But once you're in Iraq, then you're just stuck.
We are stuck.
And we are we're quite clearly stuck there, but we continue to say we need to build up our counterterrorism defenses. Now, what happened in Iraq? The final result's not in yet and may not be in for many years. But the fact of the matter is that ISIS came to power, and ISIS is a terrorist group. They committed all kinds of atrocities. And so the United States felt that we had to now wipe out ISIS. So we're continuing the war there and continuing to go after them. Now, as those people get killed, their relatives and friends are going to start going after Americans. So in my view, there's sort of a terror, counter-terror, terror dynamic.
I would say that terrorism would be almost non-existent if we butt out of other countries.
Yeah, well, you know, Monday morning quarterbacking is really easy, but think about it this way, George. Suppose if instead of invading Iraq back in 2003, we had instead gone after known terrorists and killed as many as we could and put all of our energy into that.
Which might have been a better idea.
Yeah, and we might have killed 1,000 terrorists.
And it would have been cheaper, too.
Yeah, and then we could have said to the world, okay, we're done with this. Don't mess with the United States.
That's right, because right? If you do pop up as a terrorist, we're going to come and take you out.
We'll come take you out. But now we've got this kind of global mission where we've got both the Pentagon and the CIA operating drones, sometimes independently, going into a half dozen countries to take out terrorists.
I mean, Bin Laden's number two guy, William Zawahiri, he's still alive somewhere.
I don't know how.
Why can't we go get this guy?
I just don't know how it's possible we can't find him. He's probably living in a cave, you know, someplace in Afghanistan.
This other guy, this ISIS leader, Baghdadi, that they thought was killed, the Russians thought they got him. He apparently popped up again. You know, find these people.
He did. Do you know his story at all? It's kind of interesting. He was a cleric at a university. He was a very devout religious person who his idea in life was to study the Islamic texts for the rest of his life and maybe do a little preaching. Well, he was rounded up with a whole bunch of people by U.S. troops and sent into one of those terrible jails that we had in Iraq.
Yeah.
And he was there for a couple years where he got connected up with all kinds of terrorists, all kinds of really bad people. And then he went out, and he changed his vocation, and he actually first confronted al-Qaeda in Iraq and then overcame it. He was an officer in that for a while, and then he founded ISIS. And, of course, from there on in, we know what happened. It grew as a movement, and now it's being battered down again. But I have a feeling something else will arise, you know, out of...
Probably. And what happened to al-Qaeda, William?
Well, I think al-Qaeda, the United States has been very successful in destroying most of al-Qaeda. Now, the people that work to fight al-Qaeda really need al-Qaeda. They need it because now they've got all these tens of billions of dollars to spend, and al-Qaeda, sure, somebody's got to be there to spend it on or against.
Yeah.
And I think that the al-Qaeda is more of a kind of slow movement now. And it's not well organized. It's decapitated. Its funds are gone. It's got a lot of problems. And I suspect that Al Qaeda will not be the problem in the future. But there will always be, as long as we maintain a military presence abroad, hunting down terrorists. There will always be new terrorist groups that say, "No, we're not going to let them get away with this. They're from the West. They don't understand our culture, and so we're going to get them."
Your headline, of course, of the book, the title, Democracy Betrayed, gives you the impression that democracy has been betrayed. Is it worthwhile to give up some of these freedoms for the feeling of safety? I was going to say the illusion of safety.
Well, it is the illusion of safety. And, you know, the old famous quote, I think it's by Benjamin Franklin, about someone who would give up their
rights.
Their rights and freedoms that deserve neither security nor safety nor freedom. And I think it sort of goes that way. Could you remind me of your question? I'm sorry, we've been jumping all over the place.
Well, we were talking about your title, Democracy Betrayed.
Oh, sure.
And to me, that gives you the illusion that we have an illusion of safety here.
We have an illusion of safety, but we also, increasingly, have an illusion of freedom and democracy.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have a large group in our government now, of hundreds of thousands of employees. In fact, you know, there are 1.5 million people in the U.S. government with top secret security clearances. Now, you got to think about that for a minute. They could be contractors. They could be government employees.
Right.
1.5 million with top secret. Now, what that means is the government must be hiring people who fit that description. A lot of security people, a lot of security agents. And as these numbers grow, it becomes very difficult to have our freedoms and not change into a much more authoritarian kind of state. And that's why I wrote the book, because I became concerned that if things keep going the way they're going, there will be a conversion in the nature of our democracy. And so I thought that we are betraying democracy in order to get a little temporary security, but in fact, we're not going to get that.
Let me ask you this. If a guy is in his house and he's on the internet looking at the procedures to make a bomb, and surveillance sees this and they find out and they go, all right, this guy, here's his house, he's looking at bomb-making material. Is it a good thing to invade that guy's privacy to get him before he does something?
Well, you got to ask who's looking at these things. See, for 10 years, I taught a course on terrorism and counterterrorism at the university level, and my students had to all go in and find out about these things. That's how I learned that there were bomb manuals on the internet. My students started showing them to me.
Oh, yeah, they're everywhere.
And I said to them, hey, you know, listen, probably not a good idea for you guys to go researching there. And they said, yeah, but we can research anything we want. And I said, yeah, okay. So I think too many people are interested in this topic, and they certainly would have gotten me long ago. I've probably Googled almost everything you can that has anything to do with terrorism and counterterrorism and methods of bomb making, all kinds of things.
Well, but you don't know if they checked you out. They probably said, well, this guy's a college professor, or he does this and that.
Right.
He's not going to make a bomb.
And that's the interesting thing, is you don't know whether they're looking at you or not. But you can be pretty sure that somebody's looking at you. And I wanted to just make one other point here. It might be helpful, and that is that this growth of the whole security sector of our state and our economy would not have been possible without the information technology revolution. And that revolution, which probably seems pretty blasé to young people, well, for guys like you and me, we've seen the revolution, right?
That's right.
I have an Apple iPhone 7, and I can do many things with that. It's just unbelievable. I remember when I grew up as a boy, we had one phone in the kitchen.
Oh, I'm telling you, the smartphone is your handheld computer, and it has made life so much easier in so many different ways.
It certainly has, but the same technology that goes into building the algorithms and the software and the semiconductors, the hardware for your cell phone, that same technology, it's dual use in character. It can be used to record everything that people are doing. So if you know, in this country, people are innocent until proven guilty, but there are lots and lots of agencies investigating literally hundreds of thousands of people. Now, let me explain a little bit.
Hold on for 1 second. We'll get right into that. We're already at the top of the hour, William, and we're going to come back and talk more with you about your work, Democracy Betrayed. We'll also take some phone calls with you right here on Coast to Coast AM.